Hello, and welcome to the Art of the Cut podcast, brought to you in partnership with Boris Effects and our sponsor, Jump Desktop. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. I'm a working film, TV, and documentary editor. Over the last 9 years, I've done more than 400 interviews with the world's best editors. Welcome to episode 1 of season 10. I've been using Boris Effects products for 30 years, and I'm proud to partner with them to bring you some great filmmaking content. Today on Art of the Cut, we're talking with Oscar-winning editor Pietro Scalia, ACE, about editing Michael Mann's Ferrari. Scalia won the Oscar and an Ace Eddie for JFK, was nominated for an Oscar and an Ace Eddie for Good Will Hunting, won a BAFTA and an Ace Eddie and was nominated for an Oscar for Gladiator, won an Oscar and an Ace Eddie and was nominated for a BAFTA for Black Hawk Down, nominated for another BAFTA for American Gangster, and was nominated for a BAFTA and an Ace Eddie for The Martian. Pietro has been on Art of the Cut before to discuss his work on The Martian and Alien Covenant. Pietro's other work includes Solo, A Star Wars Story, and The Amazing Spider-Man 1 and 2. Before I hop into our discussion with Pietro, a brief thank you to our sponsors. Jump Desktop is a high-performance and secure app that lets you virtually connect to your editing bay as if you were physically there. Keep all your assets in one place and connect to your powerful editing bays from anywhere. Jump Desktop's high-performance remote desktop protocol lets you edit from any low-powered laptop. With end-to-end encryption, native support for macOS and Windows, and multi-monitor support, you can be productive from anywhere. Jump Desktop also has collaborative screen sharing for collaboration with your team. See what thousands of editors have been using to get their work done from across the world. Visit jumpdesktop.com/cut to begin your free no-limits 14-day trial today. And to our partner, Boris Effects. I've been using Boris Effects and Sapphire for 30 years, so they're not just a sponsor to me. I feel like they've been a partner in my cutting room for decades, helping me to deliver on the creative vision of my clients, directors, and producers. For all of us, our work is about bringing a creative idea to the screen, and for me, Boris Effects is one of the important tools that I use to do that. To see how they can help you on your latest project, head on over to borisfx.com and check out the Boris Effects suite, which includes Sapphire, Continuum, Mocha Pro, Silhouette, and Optix, all in a low-cost monthly or annual subscription. If you want to read this interview with great visual support, you can go to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC. That site also has other great filmmaking content, so keep that bookmarked. And now, Pietro Scalia, ACE, discusses editing Ferrari. Pietro, thank you so much for joining me on Art of the Cut today, and I'm really excited to talk about Ferrari.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
This is based on a book. Did you read the book?
Yes, I did. It's Brock Yates' book. I read it after Michael had offered me the picture. I mean, I had read various drafts before that because it's a project he's been wanting to do for many years. I mean, over 20 years, I think. But he always was very generous and would always tell me he's about to go. And was always considering me. So I saw the evolution of the script, but I fell in love with the last draft. It really kind of crystallized all these years of research into the man and into his story. But I wanted to find out more, and I did also some of my own research. I mean, both on with films, with interviews on Italian TV over the years. But one book that I read was his biography called Ferrari Rex by an Italian author, Luca Dal Monte, which is basically, about 1,000 pages or more from like beginning to the end. I mean, every possible detail. And that really gave me the overview of who this man was. I didn't know a lot of the stuff. I mean, specifically his early years as a child growing up, you know, during the war and then losing his older brother, and also right after that, losing his father, growing up with his mother, trying to find work, you know, to maintain the household now that he was the only son remaining at Fiat in, when he was very young and was refused. So there's a little hint of that when he's talking to Agnelli, you know, on the phones. And so those are the kind of things that, really enrich the script. And that's what I felt, that even though it was so concise and even though it seems a fairly straight, dramatic story, there's a lot of weight and a huge amount of research behind these characters. And that really, really stood out in the way it was written and the dialogue. So finding out and researching more about Ferrari really helped me as well when, you know, getting the material and seeing this creation of this character that Michael, you know, brought to life.
Many of the editors that I've talked to about material like this that could involve research are pretty evenly split between wanting to do the research, wanting to know as much as possible, and wanting to say, I just want to know what's in front of me. I just want to see what's in the dailies.
I'm on the other side. I want to do as much research as possible. Also because you really do a deep dive and you know, exploring the world and the time, looking at archival footage, and being a fan of Formula One, growing up in Europe and following that, being a car enthusiast, going with my friend to the Geneva Auto Show and seeing the latest cars. I mean, it was always into that. Also researching, for example, the early races, the Targa Florio in Sicily, one of the big races, you know, similar to the Mille Miglia. Seeing the old heroes, the drivers, and Ferrari himself also being a race car driver in the early years, you know, until he started his own, you know, Scuderia with Alfa Romeo cars. So I like doing the research. It enriches me and helps, hopefully.
And for those who don't know your background, you are an Italian.
I'm Italian, yes. Both my parents are Southern Italians. I grew up as a son of immigrants in Switzerland, in the northern part of Switzerland. So I grew up speaking German and Italian in the household.
Michael Mann, I did my research as best I could. I didn't think you'd worked with him before. Is that correct?
That's right. It was first time. But I'd known Michael, you know, socially over the years, you know, and I've been a great admirer of his work. Big, big fan, obviously, from seeing, you know, Heat, obviously, the, you know, masterpiece. And you know, The Insider, when he was finishing Insider, we were finishing up Gladiator with Russell Crowe. So amazing performance, you know, both in Insider and I was in Gladiator. But, you know, even just going earlier on with his film Thief, which I thought was brilliantly shot. I mean, showing, you know, Chicago and Collateral. I mean, he's done a lot of amazing pictures. So it was great to finally get a chance to work with the master.
One of the first things that I wanted to talk about was the intercutting early in the film between the mass and the test track. Can you talk about whether that was scripted that way and how you chose when to go between those two locations?
Well, I just remember reading that section in the script, and I saw, oh, obviously, this is a great, you know, opportunity to cut both the energy of the racetrack, the church, the sermon, the community of Modena, both all the workers, the engineers, being concerned about on the racetracks and the stopwatches and the timing and the perspective of the locations. It really stood out on the page. So it was, you know, I was looking forward to putting it together. When the material actually came in, the way, for example, one example, the way the sermon was somewhat scripted on the page is it showed that it was going to go back and forth with the race car driving and obviously cutting to the reactions, the stopwatches, all that was in there. You know, when I first put it together, kind of followed that structure that we didn't have all the pieces, but, you know, the pieces were coming together and I was basically structuring and building it the way it was scripted. But one thing that when Michael saw, I think the first cut, he said, yeah, I don't want to cut away from the sermon too much. I want to really stay with it. And that was, I think, an interesting choice because he wanted really the words to resonate from the priest. And so the evolution of that, a lot of times was really just like, what is essential? What are the elements to show? But I think stylistically, it kind of like established very early on this dynamic or contrast between both the action of the racing versus as the dialogue-driven speech, which also reflects a lot of times, you know, the aggressive cuts and contrasts of cuts between, you know, handing the host or raising the chalice with the engine. You know, that juxtaposition and parallels you see later on in the film as well, between something, you know, very lyrical and musical, as for example the opera, to a very harsh cut to Le Mans race car driving. So both visually and you know, with sound to create dynamics. And I liked in that scene something in the evolution of the scene is both using the element of the choir in the church and continuing that over the racetrack, but at the same time incorporating the soundtrack, a very percussive musical element to it. So that combination of the music, that parallel, the juxtapositions of the action really made it, I think, very, very exciting. One of the things that was very specific as well in terms of knowing the racetrack around Modena, which is not very far probably from from the church, one of the oldest or probably one of the first racetracks in Italy. We had watched a film shot by the BBC. It was probably done like in 1950s with Fangio driving exactly that racetrack, and was very familiar with the racetrack. But one thing that Michael wanted to point out is the chicane, you know, how these drivers, these race car drivers, take the chicane and establish that as an element visually, how the car turns, how, in the first case, how Berra steers, where the position of the camera is, which later on comes in play when Castellotti goes through the chicane several times and we see how he takes it and eventually has a gear or a transmission malfunctions and loses control of it. So you visually establish the geography. And what was very interesting when we looked at the footage from the BBC and how Fangio drove, it was amazing the composition that they were able to achieve, low angle position of the tires from behind, straight point of view, frontal, you know, race car strike, and really amazing for that time to get that coverage. But it really gave us a lot of insight on the track and what good driving looks like, you know.
Can you describe what the chicane is?
Well, the chicane is when you basically, when they come on the straight and then go in the curve, like an S, that part. So it's how you enter the chicane and, you know, how you follow the perfect line. You have to both downshift and then upshift a lot. So what shows what a good driver is that we see that very early on in the film when Ferrari, you know, double clutches and changes gears. You know, basically don't lose your RPMs when you go at a certain speed. It's very tricky with your foot and changing gears, but you don't want to lose RPMs when you do that. You have to get to. So it's this double clutch thing that we established very early on in the film. That when you get into chicane, both downshift and upshift and going, keeping the speed is very, very tricky. So that's what we tried to show.
Yeah, and you definitely did that in the editing. You're showing the gear shift. You're showing
the pedals, entering the curve, leaving the curve. When it comes around the curve, you can see a lot. Michael is an amazing driver. You counter the steering wheel, how the wheels go into the curve. Try to be very precise with those elements. But that's one of the signatures of Michael's films. He researches 1,000 times more than I possibly did. But he's very, very keen of how these people that excel in what they do, how they do it, and showing it. I mean, you can go back to Thief and you see what it takes to melt down a metal vault. That's exciting, that thing. And I think that specificity and the attention to detail is what makes things stand out. Throughout my career, it's always the details about how to build something. What does it feel like? We talked in the past about Black Hawk Down, but that also was about being specific about action. The same way, you have to be very specific with performances and character. What rings true? What is too much? What is not enough? Michael is also very attuned to the performances and the subtleties. No, you don't need that extra word. It's a repeat. Just again, just paying a lot of attention to the smallest of details, a small look, a hand gesture. It's those details that make a big difference.
Some scenes go without music, obviously, and others have cues. What's guiding your decision about when to spot music, or how do you collaborate with Michael and the composer on what you think needs music?
Well, Michael has always been really at the forefront of using music very particular scores. All his films have unusual and amazing scores. This one was not easy to find the musical tone. We tried different pieces. We wanted like something thematic, as for example, as The Godfather, something recognizable. We would see what would an Ennio Morricone-like score sound like. It didn't fit somehow. It belongs to a different animal. It just didn't work. So it took some time to find out the music, but I think Michael really is very sensitive about using too much music. And I tend to agree. Sometimes, you know, when you work in temp, you do it because you don't have all the sound, you didn't have everything, and it tends to make things look good. But in terms of sound design, right at the beginning of Prince of Photography, we talked about sound and also showed ideas that the sound is going to be amazing. The car sound, specifically the sound effects. He said, yes, of course. And we talked the fact that we were using replicas of these cars, but obviously they were not 12-cylinder engines inside. They were 4-cylinder engines. Said at that point that later on we will go back and re-record the actual sound specific with the car engine. What does it sound like? What does acceleration sound like? Downshifting, braking, you know, revving, all those elements to accumulate. I think Michael was more interested in the specificity of the sound. Specifically, what does it sound like when you have a 12-cylinder engine of 12, 20 cars riding through the cobble streets of Modena, reverberating against these medieval houses in that? And that, again, shows you his attention to detail, because it is very effective. You don't need music during that time. It goes back to a famous shootout scene in Heat. The same idea, where the realism of the reverberation, and that you can't reproduce that with sound effects. You actually have to go and record it. You have to go out and record these sounds. And we did that later on when the picture was locked and we were working on the sound. Tony Lombardi went and re-recorded the sounds and you know, created that realism. Daniel Pemberton's music was very, very effective. And I liked the direction the music took, you know, the percussiveness to it, the weight of it. And a lot of times we had music and then Michael removed it, a little bit more dramatic scene, simply because it either felt too much or was not necessary. They didn't need that. So it's always a question of taste and balance. But in this particular case, it was all Michael in terms of being very specific about finding the right tone and the quantity of music that needed to be used.
It struck me with the relationship between the two women, the mother of his young child and his wife that he's married to. How did you juggle that in editing? Or didn't you feel like you had to? That was just in the script.
Well, it was in the script, but also going back and reading the book and his relationship with these two women, it wasn't a mistress. It was a woman he was in love with. His relationship with Laura was wrought with a lot of tension and unhappiness. It's not in the film, but for many years in the early years when he married Laura, the mother was not happy with that marriage. There was unhappiness there, but they did build this business together. She was as instrumental in creating and supporting him all over the years. She was also for many times away because she was not feeling well. I think it's also during the war that then he met Lena, you know, and then fell in love and had a child in such a small town like Modena, and where like everybody knows everybody's business, that he was able to keep this relationship such a secret from Laura, because he knew that, you know, would destroy her. So the two women are completely different. Laura, very powerful, strong woman, can stand up to a character like Enzo, versus Lena was maybe a more modern woman in that sense. She was educated. She was, you know, maybe had a different, more liberal view of things, not so provincial or conservative like Modena. I mean, there's hints to that. So younger, more emancipated, I guess. What you really see from the beginning, and something that, again, Michael wanted to point out, is to show very right at the beginning how tender he is with both with Lena and his son and that family, and the juggling back and forth of this life trying the best he can. It was almost like a refuge for him to go there, you know, and have a meal with his son or family. Whereas his home feels cold and depressed after the death of their son. I think after the death of Dino, I don't think the relationship ever recovered. He obviously cared about Laura just as much, but he's a completely different man with both women, I think. That had to be expressed in the performances.
When Laura discovers this second home, that was a powerful scene, I thought, and constructed with very few shots, what, six or seven? I don't know how many, but it didn't feel like a lot. And it felt each one was, you know, the discovery of the toy. And that's the first shot. When she gets out of the car, you see the toy in the foreground.
Yeah, there is, exactly. You see part of that. That's very specific. I mean, the car drives up the driveway. I mean, it's an amazing performance. And, you know, they did several takes, not too many. Penelope was spectacular. The reveal of the house, of the shot that is on her and kind of turns around and it has this, you know, classic, almost signature shot of Michael going behind the head and seeing the house in the foreground, but the expression on the face and then revealing the house, it is very, very powerful, but it is because of the performance of Penelope and approaching that. Everything that could possibly mean, I mean, it's the toy that Dino used to play with, you know, a replacement of a son at that point, you know, the toy has been given to Piero now. And you can see that later on, right before the opera, when Enzo comes into the room and says, are you going to the opera? She says, no, I'm not. She's in her bedroom. You can see that in the background is that car that she picked up, trying to retain memory of his son, which then again gets expressed emotionally. Everybody reminisces during the opera about loss and about death or a more joyous past. It's this continuous movement and melange, I don't know a better word to say that, of emotions that carry us through, both sometimes lyrically and at other times very aggressively. It's this balancing act that I was fascinated with. Ferrari, who's iconic industrialist in Italy, a huge personality, how he balanced all these elements that were affecting his life, not only the relationships between the two women, his grief about the loss of the son, his determination and desire to always be better, to be faster, to beat time, the way he would talk to the drivers or to his lawyer or to his competitor, Maserati, his interaction with the journalist, the other men. I think there's a lot of layers of Ferrari and the character that, you know, Adam Driver really pulled it together and did an amazing job. Not easy, you know, when you have to step in somebody's shoes. And there's a lot of, specifically with biography of a real person. As an editor, you get gifted these amazing performances. And so you basically just hope not to fuck it up. Yes, it takes time. Again, you know, refining and stuff. But yeah, just don't mess with it.
Stay out of the way of the performances.
Yeah, and just enhance and or rather is there and make it feel as natural and as powerful and as authentic as you can.
You hinted at the opera flashbacks. Can you talk through what those were, how they were scripted, how you changed them from being scripted? He goes to the opera and you're watching a performance and then you're watching these flashbacks.
So the opera is kind of like a central scene, central in a way. It's almost like the heart of the film in a way. It's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. I started early on that during production, I actually took upon myself to go and record the opera at the nearby theater, simply because there was discussion, are we going to be in such a case, we would use some playback. Well, what playback? I mean, it is a specific song from La Traviata, but you can't find a playback, or there's many different opera singers that sang this piece. It's very well known. But Michael was specific that he wanted to have the actual live recording of the singers. The process of how to go about that is that you can't find the playback because there is no separation between the orchestra and the singers. when an opera sings, I mean, if you want to license a playback, you can't. You don't just get the musical piece, because the orchestra is an integral part to how the singers sing to their rhythm. It's combination. It can't be separated. The performance itself dictates the meter, and the orchestra follows that. So in order to create a playback, or having the flexibility of having a recording that is separated between the singers and the orchestra, we went to a theater and want to make sure that we get the elements that Michael will use during the shoot. So first of all, we rehearsed with the singers and the orchestra. I played for them versions that I liked, and they were always all professional. Lee Orloff, who was a sound mixer, couldn't do it because they were literally shooting other parts. So during that time, when we had access to the theater, we went and recorded it. So we recorded it, we rehearsed, we found the right tempo, and then we did a live recording together. And then we did a piece. Once the conductor knew the piece and the rhythm, he just did the music. And later on, what we did is we recorded, you know, on a separate mic, the singers as well. So we were able to create a master playback that was separate, both orchestra and lyrics. However, when Michael went and shot the scene on the wide shots, for example, of the orchestra, we used playback, not trying to tire the singers. But when he shot the tight elements, that was actually live recording. What helped is that they had an earpiece, I mean, with the orchestra, you know, track that we had, and they were used to that tempo in their ear, and they would sing. We had to do a little bit of finessing afterwards, both in the editing and the mix. But basically what you see is the actual live performance. He did only about three takes of that, but it was very specific to be accurate when you're so close to the actors, because that was really central to how Michael saw the scene. You see, it's an unusual way of being so close to the singers. You usually have, you know, the wide shots, you have people reacting to the opera and the music, and in a simple way, then the music drifts next door where Adelgisa, you know, Enzo's mother, is listening to it, reminiscing about, you know, her son leaving to war. We also have a magnificent moment with Laura in almost tears with a slight smile, you know, reminiscing about the happier times in the past, you know, on the bed, as Enzo, a young, much younger man, dances and sings to the same song, that bridge, and then linking that with the very tight close-ups of the singers expressing those emotions. And specifically, you know, without being on the nose, in La Traviata and the song Parigi o Cara is really about, we will have Paris again in a certain way, but it's about his lover or his wife basically dying. So it is about death, but it is the determination to be very close to the actors as a jumping point, and to be very specific when in the song to come in. So you have various elements to play with. The most important part, obviously, is the performances of the actors, and at the same time, the performance of the tenor and the soprano, to be harmonious and to be emotional. There's a beautiful shot of Shailene Woodley being mesmerized in a way about the song and the emotion, but her flashback is the joyous moment when she, during the war, she goes and tells, you know, Enzo, I'm pregnant. It has to be work both musically where you cut, and not just, oh yeah, this is the plate, like this, and then we just cut it in and stuff like that. We spend a lot of time on that sequence, and there was a vast amount of amazing performance. You say, oh, I could just stay a minute long on Penelope Cruz's face and just experience that. It was so powerful seeing that from the dailies, or even Adelgisa, his mother, beautiful. So just her breathing in her room and her eyes, and I mean, amazing performances. So we were very, very frame accurate, not only in musically where to cut in rhythm, but that you really nail at the best moment that expression or that emotion that the actors feel. So a lot of little balancing fine tuning of that, but I'm very proud. You don't really see it, but if you analyze it, then also the song was longer. We had to fortunately trim it a little bit. Which bars do you take out without destroying it? I'm proud of that scene because it is built like a Swiss clock. If I can say. I don't want to praise myself, but I'm very proud.
I could feel it. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to ask you about that scene is because it's beautiful. It's very powerful. And
sometimes you wonder the question, I mean, besides aesthetically beautiful and emotional, what is it? When all those elements, you know, like you said, they run perfectly right, just like a fine-tuned engine. The cylinders are hitting right. I mean, you hear it in the sound, you see it visually, it's moving. It does affect the aesthetic of cinema, and those elements do affect you emotionally. That's what's amazing about it, making films when you get good material like that.
I wanted to ask you about a specific cut. I can't remember which race it was, but you'll remember. They're racing, and one of the drivers, I think, lets a driver pass him. And then it cuts mid-race to a dinner with the racers where Ferrari is basically telling them, I think it's the scene where he says two objects cannot be in the same space. Can you talk to me, was that scripted that way? Were you trying to tighten? Or were you just trying to juxtapose the cause and the effect closer to each other?
I think, no, it wasn't scripted like that. There was much more about the race and going back and forth. It was more like, you know, showing the race, seeing the hesitation of Deportago versus Vera at that moment. And you come to a much cleaner end. But I think it was Michael much later on. He wanted to be much more aggressive, not to go directly into that. So it was not planned. This is something that after many variations, I cut the dinner sequence. I did a first pass on the Le Mans section, but I think it was later on John Valerio, the additional editor, who restructured and worked that with Michael. You know, in terms of specific details, how it came to that cut, to that drastic cut, it was an evolution of various cuts, I guess.
Can you talk about constructing the beginning of the Mille Miglia race, where Ferrari's kind of giving instructions to all of his drivers as they are about to cross the starting line?
Yeah.
The importance of that, the timing of it, how you chose the angles that you chose, even the sizes.
I have to say that was a tough scene to put together because there was a lot of material, amazing material that was shot, both in terms of expressing the rules of the Mille Miglia, in a sense that, you know, it starts at midnight and the smaller cars go first every minute, that each car number progresses as the later car, the more powerful cars leave later in the race. Besides that technical part of it, which is not so important, what was more important for Michael is how he spoke to the drivers each differently, and to be able to intercut those elements with very aggressive compositions of the cars taking off the ramps, going up and down the ramp, and still keeping an order of it. We spend more time in terms of like not using the very similar compositions. And I think Michael shot it with two or three cameras. You know, we could switch back and forth. So there was always like, oh, I can be on a profile or on the frontal or, you know, go up and down. So in terms of choices, it was to make them distinct enough that each part he would talk with the driver would be slightly different in what he said. And at the same time, showing Maserati talking to Berra or to his other driver, how these two men really are giving, just like a coach, the specific instruction to each of the race car drivers. The moment we spend trying to find the right performance, and there were probably good like a dozen takes of the moment where Ferrari is basically looking over to Maserati and Berra, his competitor in the race, takes off his glasses and then puts them back on, that kind of like the iconic mask. And we played around with slowing down time, taking down the sound, having this emotional moment. So that was just tricky, just like, do we slow it down here? Where should we slow down? Do we need to get back to speed? We don't want to let the steam out in a certain way, about keep the idea of the race going, you know, but at the same time, you know, create a little break and to see how Ferrari really feels, you know, because at that moment, as a character, that's it was at stake. He needs to win the Mille Miglia. Again, going back to say, if you want to save your business, you better win the Mille Miglia. So it's a big deal for him. He has amazing drivers, but the rivalry with Maserati and his business being on the line can be felt. Hopefully at that moment that it comes down to this. But I think that Ferrari was known to be a tough taskmaster with his drivers, and also accused of being callous in terms of death, of loss, or losing these amazing drivers. But he mentions that, build a tough skin. Later on in the race, in the Mille Miglia, when they stop in Bologna and Deportago arrives, they're checking the tires and they're warned. He says, I can make it. I'm not too far away from Brescia. I can make it. There is a slight concern on Ferrari.
I was thinking about the pre-title sequence, the black and white of, with Adam Driver. I don't know what it would have been, the 30s or
20s.
The 20s, yeah.
Probably like 1920. It was when Ferrari was still a young race car driver. And we tried to create a race by using archival footage of the various races in Italy, both the Targa Florio and other races that were there. Hard to find the material of that era, because we had to be specific about the kind of car that he was driving from that period. We did some visual effects and comping elements in it. It was an idea that came later on. It was not in the script. Michael, I think it was towards the end of the shoot, the final week of Adam's driver's shoot, that he wanted to do this. And he had this beautiful Alfa Romeo restored and made him drive around the track. But basically what he wanted is to infuse the film with a sense that Ferrari was a race car driver. And he thinks like that. He knows what it means. That's why his speech to the drivers at the dinner in the restaurant is very, very telling, because he knows. He's not just a coach. He's been there. He knows what it means, what the exaltation of a race car driver means, and the passion, that drive. It can't explain. You have to be, and that's what Michael said, you have to be a race car driver to understand, why people do that. And so coaching them, he spoke to them like a race car driver.
Some of the footage of the cars themselves is fantastic. Talk to me a little bit about the racing itself, trying to construct those races, and also trying to just show the beauty of the vehicles themselves.
You just have to photograph to show how beautiful those cars are. But if you go to the Ferrari Museum in Modena and to the factory, and you see the actual cars, they're works of art in the metal. So it goes to show the craftsmanship and ingenuity of the Italian craftsmen in Modena. I mean, there's, Maserati is there, Ferrari is there. In Bologna, you have Lamborghini. I mean, they were all craftsmen using metal. And the priest even talks about how we form metals, this car engine racing into the future. But besides just being metal and machines, they're beautiful to look at. The color. I mean, people fell in love with that. That's why they wanted these cars. It represented, again, high quality, beautiful design. You don't need to do very much to shoot it. But then when you show the contrast of these futuristic looking cars racing through a medieval city, Renaissance buildings, or in Rome, or out in the vastness of the mountains, Gran Sasso, where they shot on locations, you can look at them almost mythical. The drivers being gods or heroes on chariots. I mean, it's the same element of it. And they were superstars,
You had to cut from nighttime racing, and then it's an instantaneous cut to the day racing. Talk to me about determining when something has to happen, making that cut work, that kind of thing.
This is really Michael's decision to do that, because we had a lot of material as well, more of the race. We have them at night, then early dawn, and there were some amazing shots in the race. And he shot different sections. He shot night, he shot early dawn. For example, early dawn, you see these cars on a long straight with their lights on, and it's foggy in the fog. We missed some of that. We should show geographically, but he had similar actions of passing, getting behind a driver, using it as a slingshot to pass, establishing, to do it, showing the competition between the drivers, which you repeat in different sections. And he was, both in terms of economic time, also chose to make it directly cut in the section where we are, okay, now it's not, now we're on the hills in the curvy section to it. More dynamic. I wish I had the other parts as well, but it felt it's stronger. You don't need it. It's more aggressive. So I think that really is something that, obviously, through the editing process, you see a pattern emerging. And I think that's something that I learned from Michael. And also, I have to, again, say that John Valerio, our additional editor, did an amazing job as well, working with Michael and going through some of those sections and tightening it when it was necessary.
The big tonal shift at the end of the movie and how you navigate getting from a race to a tragedy and getting the audience successfully through a jump in emotion like that.
Obviously, the race was going to be exciting. The evolution of the races, the elements that were conflicting or coming together in his life. But I was surprised by how shocking the reaction was to the tragic accident. Even on page, it was more descriptive in this violent accident that happens that took the lives of several bystanders and children. So how do you, show that? Really credit to Michael, because he pointed out to a crash that happened in 1956 in Le Mans, just a year before, where a car basically collides into a barrier and basically catapults the engine out of the car and into the audience, in the stands. And seeing that as one shot, the shot by the camera operator, it is so violent. You don't need anything. I mean, it's one shot. And I think that was fundamentally what Michael wanted to do. I wanted to show it as one shot, basically, which technically is very difficult to achieve without, nowadays with technology and visual effects and do it. So there was a lot of testing done, research done by how to achieve the crash, setting up multiple cameras, how we can enhance it later on. But we really lucked out that he did capture exactly what he wanted, the one shot. I mean, miraculously, put dummies there and to actually show how these bodies, properly weighted would actually effect. So very specific about the crash. It's not, oh, it's a crash, Hollywood crash, and so forth. It's like, it's the authenticity of how close you can get to that authenticity that makes it so impactful. On a dramatic level, though, it comes completely unexpected in a way, because you're in it, you're in the race, but the moment where basically you go at full speed and you have this ramp down in slow motion where it really just goes on the tire, and you show the explosion and then the crash of that. I was surprised how shocking that really is, because I've been working on it, and you have bodies and you have the reveal of that, which it could be, it's very, very graphic, but seeing the reactions of the audience to that and how shocking that is, I wasn't aware of it, but it works, I guess.
Did you have footage of the celebration at the end of the race, which there is just like one shot of a wreath placed around someone's neck? But
yeah, there was
not like crossing the finish line.
There was more. I mean, there was, again, trying to be economical and cut it down. Working with Sarah Gadon's character, the actress, the Portago's girlfriend, being there, being clueless, not knowing what happening is. I think the focus was on that, like, have you seen the Portago, talking to Collins? No, I haven't seen him. So leaving that, there were other pieces that we had lost.
The feeling was once the audience knew that they'd won the race, then the focus needed to shift back to this.
Yeah, it needed to shift. I think we had to go back to Enzo coming onto the site and seeing how it affects him that moment. I think that's the more important storyline, not who won, I mean, obviously.
Was there anything of Enzo being informed that there had been an accident? Because in the movie, as it's shown, he just shows up at the crash site.
Yeah, you have to understand, and maybe it's not so explicit, but I mean, the race starts in Brescia and ends there where it started. Modena is not that far from Brescia. It could be an hour and a half. He would go in different sections following the race. He didn't go to Rome, he didn't go to the mountains, but when they came back, he was in Bologna, he moves back and forth, he goes back to Modena, he has the phone call with Agnelli. So he's always there and present. It wasn't necessarily how he was informed. He just shows up because the police was there. And, you know, and it turned into a big deal for him. He was indicted for manslaughter. He had to defend himself for years. They're trying to blame Ferrari and his cars, but it was a long legal battle. But trying to move through these events in an economical way when the wreck of the car, which was meticulously replicated exactly how the car was done. I mean, there was a lot of research and images that people studied this crash because there was a trial and, you know, how could this have happened? What caused it and all that? I mean, it was so well documented trying to move forward that after the crash site, when we cut back to Modena, to the factory and the body of this wreck is being pulled into the machine room to kind of like this carcass to be analyzed, like an autopsy. It felt like a body being taken off and analyzed and looked at, you know, going through it. What was the cause of it? To move through these events in a good pace. I mean, there's so much good stuff. And, you know, as an editor, there's a German word, maybe I've mentioned this to you, die Qual der Wahl, which basically means the agony of choice.
We need that on a t-shirt.
Die Qual der Wahl.
Agony of choice works for me. Pietro, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Good luck.
That's it for Art of the Cut this week. Thank you so much for listening. Again, if you'd prefer to read this interview with visual support and clips and trailers, head on over to borisfx.com/blog/AOTC, where there's a ton of great expert content for filmmakers of all types. Also, check out my book, Art of the Cut, Conversations with Film and TV Editors, for a topic-driven curated look at the craft of editing. Thanks to Pietro Scalia, ACE, for joining us on Art of the Cut. And thanks to our partner, BorisFX, and to our sponsor, Jump Desktop. Be sure to check them out at borisfx.com and jumpdesktop.com/cut. I'm Steve Hallfish, ACE. Thanks for listening. And please tell all the editors and filmmakers that you know that to get more great Art of the Cut interviews every week, please subscribe on your favorite podcast app.